So for the last couple of weeks, we've been discussing Martin Luther. And last week, we spoke about a number of things as we began to go into more of his public life. The week before, we spoke primarily about his birth and his upbringing, his university years, and then following on to the verge of when he came to the 95 Theses, which are pretty much what is considered sort of like the informal, in a way, beginning of the Protestant Reformation. That occurred in 1517, which was a pivotal year for the Reformation. And in that year, he wrote not only the 95 Theses, but also a thesis against scholasticism. The 95 Theses we mentioned were written in Latin. And so they were purposely written in Latin, first of all, because that was the language that the church used, but also, secondly, because they were intended to create debate within the church. They were not for public consumption. And, however, they were translated into German and sent all throughout Germany, and so they created quite an uproar. They were motivated by Luther's pastoral concerns for his flock, first and foremost. We also mentioned the Tower Experience, the fact that Luther was wrestling with his soul for many years. It wasn't just here at the beginning of his public persona, but for many years he was wrestling with his soul and the problems of sin. He would confess very often. His breakthrough, however, came when he was teaching from Romans 1, verses 16 and 17. Of course, that's a famous passage. We probably all know it by heart. The just shall live by faith. That's when he understood that the just live by faith, not by works. This came, by his own reckoning, in around 1518, which was after the thesis. And so he doesn't feel that he had reached that breakthrough before he wrote the thesis. Then we also spoke about how he wrote three treatises. The first one was to the Christian nobility, exhorting them to act justly. Then he wrote a treatise on the freedom of the Christian man, which basically is a summary of his beliefs, primarily justification by faith, explaining to the Pope what his belief system was and why he was doing the things that he was doing. And then he also wrote a treatise on the Babylonian captivity of the church. And this was a treatise that was primarily addressing the issue of the sacraments. And how we discuss how at the beginning of the treatise, he accepts three sacraments, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and also penance. And then by the end of the treatise, he had changed his mind and only baptism and the Lord's Supper counted as sacraments in his estimation. And then we spoke about the Diet of Worms, which is where we left our last message. He was not allowed to speak there. He was condemned as a heretic by this council. But then after the council, he's kidnapped by his friends, taken to Warburg Castle, where he translates the Bible into German. He spends 9 months there and translates the Bible into German. And so we come to this week where we will take Luther home, as it were. We discussed a little bit, by way of introduction last week, how we were going to get into the 1520s and some of the other developments during the 1520s. We spoke about Worms, of course, which was 1521, the summer of 1521. Then he goes to Warburg, translates the Bible. And in 1524, Erasmus of Rotterdam writes a treatise on a diatribe on the freedom of the will, is what he termed it. Erasmus, I had mentioned, I believe, last week, that had translated the New Testament, or had published a New Testament in Greek and in Latin, which is called a diglot. And so side by side, you had Latin with Greek. It's sort of like some of the Bibles nowadays. I have a Bible where it's in Spanish on one side and then in English on the other side. And so that's the idea of what Erasmus did. He took the original Greek and published into a diglot side by side with Latin. This was something that helped Luther immensely. Because, for example, when he saw the idea of repenting In the original, in Latin it said do penance, whereas in the original it said repent, which is a totally different idea. Rather than doing certain things by way of penance, it was the idea of turning, of changing your mind. And so that's what got Luther started on the way to justification by faith and unleashed pretty much this whole Reformation. In the Diatribe of the Freedom of the Will, Erasmus criticized Luther. He believed in reforming the church, but he sought to do so through culture and education, not through theological debate and schism, which is what he thought Luther was accomplishing by writing his thesis and doing what he was doing. Erasmus is a humanist. We mentioned that humanists in the 16th century were not humanists in the way that we termed it today. Today, humanist would be considered somebody who considers the human sort of like the sum of all things. You know, humanity is it. Whereas in the 16th century, a humanist was much more holistic in his thinking. Obviously, they were not atheists. Erasmus himself was a priest. And so humanism at the time was much different. And so humanists, including Erasmus, supported Luther up to a point. They believed that Luther was a victim of the ignorant hierarchy of the church, primarily the Pope. They believed him to be a fellow humanist. But eventually, and we'll see this a little later as well, they turned on Luther and believed that Luther was going too far. Sort of like the same idea as Erasmus. He's going too far, he's creating schism within the church, and that's not a good thing. So what happens is that the church puts pressure on Erasmus to attack Luther and seek to erode humanist support for Luther. Erasmus, however, initially didn't want to criticize Luther. He thought that Luther's work was, in general, a positive thing. And as I mentioned, Erasmus himself wanted the church to be reformed. You know, he had the idea of reforming the church and reforming it from within. It is important to understand that Erasmus never broke with the church. In that sense, he was like Staupitz, who had some ideas about reforming the church, the need for reform, but he never could bring himself to breaking with the church completely, like Luther eventually did later on in his life. So an attack on Luther and a support for the freedom of the will is what this diatribe was all about. Erasmus believed that everything begins by faith. And so in that respect, Erasmus and Luther agreed. However, he believed that we must give some place to the will, even if it's a small place, but one nonetheless. And in his treatise, he said that the man who works is worthy of salvation, which, again, was one of the planks of the dual planks of the Roman Catholic system of grace and works. And so Erasmus was showing in clear ways that that is what the Catholic Church believed. Luther saw this, however, as a very important challenge because he believed that the idea that God is sovereign, that it is only by the grace of God that we are saved, and that he initiates everything, including our own response to his call, was essential to understanding how salvation works. And so in 1525, the year later, he published On the Bondage of the Will. And really, it was a debate back and forth between Erasmus and Luther. Now, it wasn't a debate in person. It was a debate basically by letters. And so one will receive a letter and he will respond and send it on. And so it would take sometimes weeks, maybe even months, between one letter and the next to take place, but both of those treatises were eventually published as books. And so Luther believed The Bondage of the Will to be his best theological work. If you have read The Bondage of the Will, it doesn't read like books of today, obviously. And it is a lot more ad hominem, if we want to use that term. In other words, he uses attacks against Erasmus himself. Sometimes he calls him simplistic or a simpleton or things of that nature. And so again, we got to understand the 16th century, the language is a little different. And so the way that people address each other and disagree with each other were a lot different than it is today. And so if you have an opportunity to read that book, and I highly recommend it, bear that in mind. that, you know, you may think that Luther is being sort of angry or insulting, but he's not really doing that. If you read Erasmus's part of the argument, and there is a book that has been published that it is about the debate, and so both of those are in book form, you'll see that his language is the same, pretty much. You know, he attacks Luther as well, and so they did it both on that score. So he answers Erasmus, and he says, man cannot help himself. It is all of God. And then he appeals to Augustine concerning predestination and the fact that Augustine had spoken about, there was a famous saying of Augustine that went something to the effect that God command what you will and give what you command. In other words, the idea that God commands what he wants us to do, but he gives us the ability to do those things that he commands us to do. And so that is what Luther was appealing to. It was another way of him demonstrating that his ideas were nothing new. He was not some innovator who had come, you know, Johnny come lately, and had decided that these things were the truth, even though nobody before him had said so. So on one of these were, this was one of the basic issues of the Reformation, really, what the will, the function, the place of the will in salvation was. After this point, however, a lot more humanists turned from Luther, because again, the humanists were more of the idea that the will has to have a part in everything, including salvation. But there were many who did not. And interestingly enough, the majority of those who did not became pastors and preachers. And they promoted the truth of the Protestant gospel, which is pretty interesting. And I guess it's no different today, right? You have individuals who resist. There's other individuals who finally come to the understanding of the truth. And a lot of times those individuals who at first were reluctant eventually become some of the greatest defenders of the truth, and that's what happened in this case. Later on, he married in the 20s, he marries Catherine Bombora, who it's an interesting story. It wasn't so much about love at the beginning, his marriage, but it was primarily about Christian liberty. You know, just like we talked about, Karlstadt had gotten married to demonstrate that he was free to do so. A lot of monks and a lot of nuns at the time did that. They got married sort of like to thumb their noses at Rome and say, see, we have freedom to do this. And they left their convents and married. Sometimes they married each other. And so this was a fairly common practice here at the beginning of the Reformation, because it was done with a purpose beyond simply marrying the person. Initially, Catherine was going to marry somebody else, but she was resistant to the idea, didn't want to marry this individual. So what happens is that they end up getting married to each other, Luther and Catherine. You know, Luther was sort of like talking to Catherine about these issues, and eventually they got together and got married. The relationship, however, even though it began more as Christian liberty than anything else, eventually developed into deeply affectionate one. And Luther spoke about the Christian home being the school of character. And so, very important issue there. Of course, at the time, schooling was primarily done in homes. You know, it was the parents that were charged with educating their children. And the education at the time was quite interesting. You know, they would learn foreign languages. They would learn Greek. You know, they would learn sometimes Latin as well. They would learn to debate in Greek and in Latin. And so, it was a very, very interesting, very important, very in-depth education that children receive. And that's why they went to university. Sometimes we read about some of the Puritans going into the university at 14, 15 years old and graduating a year or two later. And so they were extremely intelligent people. They had no TV, and so, you know, books was their entertainment, right? We talked a little bit last week about the Peasants' Revolt, 1524 and 1525. So what happens is that the peasants, their grievances finally reach a breaking point. And they have these grievances against the nobles and claim that the nobles were taking their rights away. There was a lot of poverty because, as I mentioned, you know, you had basically the haves and the have-not. There was not really a middle class to speak of yet, even though that was developing. As I mentioned the first week, because in part of the plague and how it killed so many people in Europe. A third of Germany was having problems with this uprising. Thomas Münster was one of its leaders, and he was a fairly radical individual. He believed that those free in Christ have the right to take up arms to defend their rights. And Luther, however, on the other end of the scale, was dismayed at this social unrest. Society, he believed, was always hovering on the brink of chaos. And he believed that Christians under no circumstances should take up the sword to defend any so-called right. He appealed or was appalled that any Christian would take up the sword in the name of right. He thought that the peasants were betraying the cause of Christ and fighting against the teaching of the Reformation. And that was an important aspect of the whole thing as well, because Luther thought that this rebellion was going to tarnish the Protestant, the Reformation. And so he called for moderation. He wrote a treatise, Admonition to Peace, in which he talks about how the peasants should put down their arms. The two sides should work together to bring about an amiable result. However, with the continuing disorder, he eventually calls for the suppression of the peasants in a violent way. And he writes the harsh book against the robbing and murderous hordes of peasants. He criticized the nobility, but he laid the primary guilt at the feet of the peasants. Münster, who up to this point had been a close friend of Luther, broke with him over the revolt and wrote a scathing critique against Luther, calling him Dr. Liar, spiritless, soft living flesh in Wittenberg. And so we see a break between the two sides there, unfortunately. We'll talk a little more about the end of that here in a bit. But let's now transition into the Diets of Speyer and the Colloquy of Marburg. The Diets of Speyer, and there were a couple of them, and the Colloquy of Marburg were unrelated to each other, but there were important events that took place in the middle to the end of the 20s. And they had a great effect on how the Reformation continued. They took place between 26 and 29, 1526 and 1529. The Diets themselves were primarily political events, but, as I mentioned, they had a strong impact on the Reformation and the course that it took in Europe. We've been told by Tim a number of times that what most of what is termed Christendom, beginning at the onset of the Middle Ages, was of the sacralist variety, and that is that the state and the church were basically one and the same. The dominant church, which was the Roman Catholic Church, was allied with the state government, and we have some cases where even some of the princes and some of the kings and so on and so forth would be appointed by the Pope to be the regent of a particular era. At the onset of the Reformation and for some time after, however, the first generation of the Reformers, even into the second and thereafter, the Protestant churches, however, kept this same arrangement for the most part. In other words, it wasn't just a clean break. One day you had Rome being a sacralist society, and then the next day, all of a sudden, you have the Protestant church being totally separate from the state. It didn't happen that way. I have mentioned before, for example, in England, even to this day, the Queen is officially the head of the church. In practice, really, not really, but officially, she still is. Many countries in Europe, which went the Protestant way, still have state churches to this day. And they demanded allegiance to that state church, even under the penalty of death. In Geneva, for example, the famous case of Michael Servetus, who maybe Tim will mention when he speaks of Calvin, demonstrates the link between the church and the state. It was the church that condemned Servetus for being a blasphemer. However, the state was the one that carried out the execution of this individual. And so it wasn't until about the middle of the 17th century that this really began to change. And you have people such as John Owens, for example, calling for religious liberty in the middle of the 17th century. And so, but it's important to bear that in mind because that will have relevance in these diets. So obviously, you know, some people might think that sacralism is a good thing. Others may not. You know, I'm not arguing the merits of either system. I'm just saying that this is the way it was in that time. And so it is with this background that the Diet Spires took place. It's important for us who are removed from these events by centuries to understand what was going on at the time. Many of the actions and attitudes of the participants were shaped by the climate that existed at the time. It is a prevalent idea nowadays, especially in our society, to judge historical figures by our current set of values and our modernism. In other words, we wouldn't have acted that way, therefore they shouldn't have acted that way, not bearing in mind the historical context of the time. And so when we talk about the Diet's aspires, first, the first Diet in 1526 was sort of like an advance for Protestantism. But then the one in 29 was not. The Reformation had created deep fissures between the parties. You know, there was a lot of division between the parties here, even within Protestantism, because there were some, like I mentioned, the aforementioned Munster, for example, and others, I mentioned Karlstadt last week, who were of a more radical bent, and they wanted to just eliminate any semblance of Catholicism from the new church. Others, and Luther was one among these, wanted to go at a more gradual pace. You know, he wanted to reform the church, but he didn't want reform it in a radical way, just sort of like destroying things at once. In a way, you kind of make a parallel between the way that the New Testament views slavery and the Reformation, the way that Luther viewed the Reformation. And what I mean by that is that the New Testament doesn't come out and outright condemn slavery. However, it talks about it in ways that will lead the reader to understand that slavery is something that needs to go away, that needs to pass away. But the writers of the New Testament understood that in order that for them to do something radical at the time would have been more harm to the church than would have been help to society, and would have created a tremendous amount of discord. And so I think that that was the way that Luther viewed the Reformation. Up to this time, the church had exerted its complete dominion over everyone by force if necessary. We have the story of Huss, for example, who got burned at the stake. Wycliffe was not, but he was still persecuted. And so, but now what happens? The Reformation accelerates and empowers the divisions within the church to an extent that hadn't happened before. Now with Luther at the helm, so to speak, you know, everybody looks at Luther as sort of like their leader. And so now people become more bold and they're able to say, okay, we're going to go against the church more than they had ever done so before. The Edict at Worms, as I mentioned, declared Luther a heretic, condemned him to death, and anyone who would dare to follow his example or provide him any kind of aid was also to be condemned to death. At this time, the biggest perceived political challenge to Europe was not so much the Reformation, however, as big of a challenge as that was, but the Muslim threatened Muslim invasion. Listen to what John Hope puts, or how he puts this particular issue. There was great angst of Christians in the 16th century about imminent military invasion and conquest by Suleiman the Magnificent and the Ottoman Empire. This Muslim superpower was at its most aggressive stage of westward conquest when Christianity was sorely divided by Protestant and Catholic tensions. So Islam was expelled from Spain at the end of the 15th century. We know that, but it was still on the move elsewhere in the continent. It had not completely retreated. Ottoman Empire was primarily Turkish. The high water mark of that empire in Europe was the southern part of the Kingdom of Hungary. And so in 1526, the Diet of Spires is convened to deal with a looming Muslim invasion and to determine what is to be done with the persistent Reformation and its political adherents. And so it has a dual purpose. It wants to deal with the Muslim invasion. What are we going to do about this issue? And then also the fact that it wants to deal as well with the Reformation, because that too is creating problems for a lot of these kingdoms. Many within Germany had embraced Luther and his demands for church reform. Luther, as time goes by, is increasingly detaching himself from the Roman church. His political protectors are doing the same. And so they're more and more drawing away from the Roman church. So his inability to change the church from within even though at the beginning that's what he was wanting to do, is leading him to reject the church more and more. As I mentioned about the peasant revolt, also has great effect here at this point. There were 9 primary points dealing with freedom to pursue the welfare of the peasants. That too is dealt with in 1526. The German peasants were the beast of burden for society, and they were no better than slaves, Schaffs puts it. Some were radical, some were not. But nevertheless, as Luther called for suppression, a lot of them began to see Luther in a negative light and drew away from him. But perhaps the greatest after effect of the rebellion was that the princes is now were the real ruling force in their countries. Alliances for and against Rome were formed and strengthened. And so you had certain areas, certain principates that are pro-Catholic, pro-Rome, and then you have others that are fiercely anti-Rome. And so that division is creating a great political concern for the emperor and for some of the other rulers. The Protestants had become increasingly bold, and they were showing their true beliefs more and more. They were more open about about what they believed. They were aided in part by the fact that the emperor and the pope had a quarrel with each other. And I think I mentioned this last week, how the pope and the emperor had a quarrel that went on for a number of years. The pope wanted Francis of France to be the emperor, to be elected the emperor, but Charles of Spain was the one that ended up being elected. And so they had a quarrel going on. There was a war of domination for Italy at this time as well that distracted the emperor. German and Spanish forces had invaded and sacked Rome. And so you had all of this political turmoil going on. And so the Diet called for a general national council that should convene to settle the religious question, among others. In the meantime, every state shall live, rule, and believe as it may hope and trust to answer before God and His Imperial Majesty. And so the Diet aspires, one in 1526, practically said, okay, every principate has their particular authority to live as they want with the religious question. And so nobody can infringe upon those things until this council is convened. However, the settlement did not invalidate the Edict of Worms. If you were seen to support Luther in any way, you still were subject to the to execution and the sanctions of the state, which is a little bit contradicting there, because if you're being given the authority to be a Protestant in essence, but then you're being told that, no, if you are a Protestant, if you follow Luther, then you're still subject to sanctions by the state. That's a little contradictory. But nevertheless, that was what the Diet came to a conclusion on. The council that the Diet called for was postponed, and eventually is postponed for 20 years. Eventually it takes place in 1545. Which is has come to be known as the Council of Trent. And so that goes on for a while. 1545, of course, is just before Luther dies. The princes, however, see what Spires is saying as a free reign to do what they want religiously. And so that's what they do. Luther saw it as a temporary acquittal of his heresy. The practical effect in Germany was the development of various states. Those with Protestant rulers are Protestant, and those Catholics are Catholic. The head of the state also was the head of the church in that particular land. Each ruler decided the question for himself. There were divisions, however, even within the Protestants and the Catholics, as there want to be, right? There's always political divisions, even if you have more or less the same manner of thinkings. Pretty much all of the local congregations submitted themselves passively to all of these decisions. You know, they didn't rebel, they didn't protest, they pretty much went along. Tolerance was given only reluctantly, however, from the heads of the churches. The Protestants were as oppressive of those who disagreed with them as the Catholics have been. And so there wasn't much of a change there. Just because you were a Protestant ruler didn't mean that you were somehow more tolerant of Catholics than the Catholics have been of the Protestants. If you ever seen the movie or read about the Anabaptists, for example, how in Geneva, in Zurich, they were persecuted. And even Zwingli was one of the folks that agreed with their persecution because they disagreed with infant baptism primarily and a number of other things. And so that demonstrates that, you know, the Protestants in many instances were just as bad, unfortunately. The actual organization of churches in Lutheran territories was quickly accomplished. Lutheran churches were substituted for those churches that had been ruled by bishops. And they pretty much kept the same general framework, though. There was a bishop, and then there were the priest and so on within that framework. And so basically what the Protestants did was take over the infrastructure that was already in existence by the Catholic Church. So the second diet expires is where Protestants actually are called Protestants. And this is convened to discuss the issue of the Turks again and the Protestants. Catholics, however, showed up in force in this second diet. The advance that had taken place at Spires I is not now rescinded. Hence, the protestation of those individuals who eventually come to be known as Protestants. The Protestants said that the church was again in the hands of Caiaphas and Pilate. And the term Protestant, just like originally the term Christian was sort of used as a derisive term of believers, the same thing happens with Protestants here. It is used by Catholics as a term of derision for the individuals. However, they take it on, and as they say, the rest is history. To this day, Protestants are still called Protestants. They protested against the rescinding of what they saw as their rights, but they rebelled peacefully, not by arms this time. The previous arrangements, even though they had officially been withdrawn, in fact remain. And so every princess went back to its land and did what they wanted anyway. So in 1529, as a result of that diet inspired, by the way, and some of the political events that were taking place, a lot of the Protestants have been divided from one another. And so a colloquy is called at Marburg to bring together the Protestant factions. Luther and Melanchthon were against all alliances, however. Melanchthon was the eventual successor of Luther. And so they believed that any alliance with anybody with whom they disagreed, whether it was military or political, would weaken the Protestant cause. Philip of Hesse, however, sought to bring about a council to heal that schism because he thought that such a schism was going to be detrimental to the Protestant cause. He was sympathetic with the Zwinglian side. Zwingli was the primary reformer in Zurich in Switzerland. So they came together to discuss 14 particular points dealing with various issues within the church. And eventually, both sides, the Zwinglian side and the Lutheran side, agree on 13 of the 14 points, but one, and that is the Eucharist. Luther and Zwingli had two different views of the Bible. And it's important to understand, to know why they came to that divergence in their belief of the Eucharist. Luther believed that whatever is not against the Bible should be allowed, whereas Zwingli believed that whatever is not found in it should be opposed. In the end, however, the Eucharist question became a division that could not be healed. And there's the famous phrase that Luther kept repeating time and time again, and he even wrote on the table there where they were meeting, hoc est corpus meum, which is, this is my body. And what Luther was trying to get across is that the Lord said, this is my body. Therefore, it is the body of the Lord. It is not, as the Zwinglians claim, a symbolic thing, but rather more of a literal view. Luther did not believe in transubstantiation, however. He did not believe that the bread and the wine somehow miraculously became the body and blood of the Lord. However, he believed in consubstantiation. Tim mentioned this several months ago when he spoke about the Eucharist, in the fact that the Lutherans to this day believe that the body of Christ is in, over, underneath, with the emblems. And so, you know, they're not physically the body of Christ, but they're nevertheless there in a real way. Zwingli, however, believed more in a mystical view, more of a symbolic view. Eventually, Luther calls the Zwinglian side people of a different spirit. And so even though Zwingli at the end of the conference attempts to reconcile with Luther, even extends his hand and says, you know, we may have disagreed about the Eucharist, but we're still brothers. Luther spurned that attempt and didn't shake Zwingli's hand. And as an epilogue to that unfortunate event, Zwingli later on dies in battle. He was a chaplain with some of the forces there in Zurich that were battling some of the Catholic forces. He is killed in that battle. When Luther finds out that Zwingli is dead, he acts very ambivalent. You know, he doesn't think anything great about it because, you know, he believed that Zwingli was not a true believer. And so a very sad end to that episode. So what is the legacy of Luther? Right, and I know we sort of stopped abruptly. Luther lives for another 16 years from 1530. He doesn't die until 1546. He continues to write. He continues to battle, obviously. Dies of natural causes eventually, and in the place where he was born. And but I think that, you know, if we were to continue to talk about Luther, we could be at it for months. But the primary issue that he said in motion took place primarily from 1517 to 1530. And so I think that that is something that we can say we have covered him in detail. So what is his legacy? First and foremost is the supremacy of the word and its preaching. Whereas before this time, the Catholic Church had engaged in what is called a homily, basically, you know, just kind of talking and talking and talking. Not primarily about the text itself. You know, they do read texts of Scripture in the Catholic Church, but they don't really preach about the text and about its meaning and what it means for the congregation and so on and so forth. Now the pulpit is at the center of the worship and eventually becomes at the center physically. If you go to European churches of this period, you will see that most of them have the pulpit on the side. And it's not really even a pulpit. It's sort of like an elevated place where the priests would stand and would give their homilies. But eventually the pulpit is moved back to where it belongs, in the center of the building. Just as we can imagine in the early days of the church, when the disciples came together and the preaching of the word was central to everything. Luther believed that everything can be spared except the word. And he preached consecutively through books, was the first one to make that a common practice. Preaching should be simple, he believed. It should be designed for the ordinary Christian, not the intellectual. And it should be in the common language. I mentioned before that masses up to this point were conducted in Latin. Hardly anyone knew Latin. And so when a mass would take place, people didn't understand anything that was going on. Right, because they didn't know the language that was being spoken. Now with the reformers, that changes. And so every country is going to give the liturgy in their own language. Luther was also a dramatic preacher. He captured the drama of the text, and he painted a picture, a very vivid picture. Another point of Luther's legacy, something for us to remember, is that God can draw a straight line with a crooked stick. And in essence, the reality is that if God is going to use humans to accomplish his work, that's all there is. Every stick is a broken stick. You know, there's no such thing as a straight stick. Luther had his flaws, you know, and yet God used him mightily. He was controversial on the peasants' revolt. Perhaps he was too harsh in calling for the suppression of that revolt. He was for the Jews and wanted to convert them at first, and then towards the end of his life, he was against the Jews and wanted, you know, he wrote scathingly about them in ways that even spoke about making them destitute in some cases. Nevertheless, even with those glaring flaws, his work was monumental. And I think that something that Luther repeated often says a lot about the reality of not only him, but us as well. And it was simul justus et peccator, which means at one and the same time we are justified, but we are sinners. And so the fact that we have been justified, doesn't mean that we no longer sin. We are still sinners. And that is demonstrated in the life of Luther and in our lives as well. You know, if somebody was to take a microscope to our lives 100 years down the road, I'm sure they'll find a lot of flaws there as well. And so he was no different. And then finally, justification by faith, which again was the cornerstone of the Reformation. The freedom of the believer, no longer under yoke of interminable works. In other words, the works treadmill is no longer there. Now we are justified by our faith. And the works that we perform are works of love, works that have been motivated by the fact that we have been declared justified and righteous in the sight of God. At his deathbed, Luther was heard to utter these words: "We are beggars, this is true." And sort of like Richard Baxter, something that Tim often quotes, beggars telling other beggars where to find bread, and that's what we are. Indeed, we are beggars, this is true. No matter who we are, no matter how great works we may have accomplished, it is only because of God's grace and only because of God's condescension that we achieve anything, not only in this world, but also eternal life in the world to come. And so hopefully that has been useful and inspiring to you, for us to be able to learn from Luther and his life.